The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing trade finance, cash management and investor solutions to Cybos 2021. The bravery to imagine, that's Africa. Nasity Absa is a registered FSP. I'm very pleased to tell you that I'll be broadcasting on Friday evening from the start of the Absa Cape Epic. I think it's going to be fabulous. We'll learn a lot more about the cycling industry and, of course, and how it has coped in lockdowns. 18,000 people, of course, took to the streets of Cape Town for the Cape Town Cycle Tour, which happened on Sunday, and by all accounts, it was a great event, and people are very excited to be back out on the roads of Cape Town. The Cape Epic, of course, is a far more difficult beast to master, and a far smaller group of people, of course, will participate in that. But we're going to learn a lot about the cycling industry, which is a rapidly growing industry in South Africa. We're going to chat to Matt Brownell in just a second. He's the head of brand marketing at Yoko. They've got exclusive data which does show what is happening in the South African small business sector, people who utilize their Yoko payment devices, and some fascinating insights there, giving some hope, I think, in terms of people who create their own enterprises, manage to make sort of chart their own path, if you like. So much so that Lisa Illingworth, the chief executive at Future Proof South Africa, will join us later on. And she has made it her mission to get business studies or entrepreneurship taught in schools. And something that she posted on LinkedIn earlier today really resonated with me. And I'd like her to share that with you coming up at about 10 to 7 this evening. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, and Wendy Nola started telling us a story last week about a person who'd agreed, according to the company that she was talking to a change in terms and conditions on her bank account. The company involved said it had explained the change to her, the payment holiday that she'd agreed to as a result of COVID-19. She needed a break. The bank said, sure, no problem. And she then disputes what they said. They dispute what she said. And he said, she said, blah, blah, blah. And it's been a quest over a week to get the tapes. You're always told that the tapes exist. We'll go back to the tapes and the tapes will tell us what you said and what we said. But try and find the tapes, because the tapes, of course, don't exist. These are digital conversations. Wendy hopefully would have heard the so-called tapes by the time we chat to her in the next hour and 15 minutes here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Perhaps it's the boy in me, but I was certainly very excited today to see yet another rocket going off into space, 100 kilometers above the Earth. It's the second Blue Origin rocket, and therefore the third of these trips, Space Jollies. But Jeff Bezos is leading the pack now. He's done one. Richard Branson has done two. Richard Branson's company has done one, and Elon Musk is yet to fire as it comes to space tourism. But William Shatner, of course, Jeff Bezos uses celebrity to gain notoriety in this battle, this big peeing contest between billionaires. William Shatner becomes the oldest person in history ever to go to space, in 90 years old, and he's boldly gone where no human being his age has gone before. You know, a lot of people talk about this as a vanity project, a waste of time and space, and not a waste of space, but certainly a waste of time and money that could be used far better elsewhere. But there is something terribly exciting about the fact that you are able for 10 minutes to lob a rocket up into the sky and experience weightlessness and then safely parachute down again.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
There's no doubt that the broader economy is recovering, even though it might not feel like it. The business confidence remains low. Unemployment is, of course, stratospherically high. But we are seeing sections of the economy dominated by the resources sector growing thanks to high commodity prices and, fortunately for all of us, paying royalties and taxes. Now, Yoko, which supplies digital card technologies to small businesses, tell us today that business is slowly beginning to return to something that resembles normal. Matt Brownell is the head of brand marketing at Yoko. Talk to me about what you are seeing in the data that you collect as a result of the payments that are made on the machines belonging to your customers.
Evening, Bruce. Yeah, we are seeing some really positive signs, I think it's a short story. It is the time of the year where it becomes slightly difficult to differentiate between what is a seasonal change. As we head into summer, a lot of the retail sectors in particular do benefit from sort of seasonal increases in spending. And what's the impact of the easing of lockdowns? But you know, what the data is showing us is a very consistent and significant improvement, which really happened at the end of July when we moved from level 3 to level 2 and has improved again since the move further down, sorry, from 4 to 3 and improved further down to level 2 now. So it's about in total a 30% improvement from that point at the end of July to where we are today.
Okay, so I mean, there's definitely a sense that things are getting back to normal. Is it sector specific or is this across the board for your, 150,000 customers or thereabouts?
Yeah, there's actually two data points which stand out, one sectoral and one geographic. The one data point, which is the food and beverage or hospitality sector, they have clearly benefited the most from the easing of lockdowns. And we are seeing, you know, significant improvements there, particularly at the level 2 point, to such an extent that food and drink is now at its highest level since pre-pandemic. So even better than the sort of peak season of last year when we were in, you know, quite like eased lockdown nature. And then the second is geographic, which is the Western Cape. And, you know, you mentioned the cycle tour earlier on, and there is a lot of domestic tourism activity, which is definitely kicking off in the Western Cape. And we have now, for the very first time since March of last year, seen the Western Cape get back to its pre-pandemic levels, specific to this SME sector, which is, of course, not representative of the broader Western Cape economy, but is a really interesting indicator of health. And I believe it's largely tourism-driven, still mostly domestic. But, you know, anecdotally, walking on the streets of Cape Town at the moment, you are starting to hear foreign sort of accents for the first time in 18 months. And it talks a lot to the improvements that we're seeing in that region specifically.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we come off the red lists, of course, and the planes become available and people do start traveling internationally, then that can only improve in terms of creating the sort of volumes that these small enterprises need to become sustainable once again. And that'll be absolutely brilliant. It's this idea and the importance of financial inclusivity, because in an economy like ours, which is so exclusionary, 44% of working age adults are excluded from jobs, for example, we desperately need some sort of financial inclusion to get the economy recovering more broadly, don't we?
We certainly do. And I think that, you know, it's amazing that as soon as you give a small business a digital footprint, and that digital footprint can be really in terms of payment processing or technology, you provide a huge ability to tap into things which are currently excluded, whether it's access to capital or access to markets. Digital footprints are a good starting point, and you know the reality of financial inclusion in the SME space largely starts with something as simple as that, actually.
I mean, and you've got your data proves it as well. I mean, you've kept track of data right from the very start of Yoko, and you've looked at sort of pre and post the digitization of payments, and people who have got these digital payment devices, these little blue boxes, see dramatically increased sales, at least in the beginning, and then they create a new base for growth into the future when they start accepting cards and other payments, and perhaps, you know, the likes of the Snap scans and those sorts of devices.
Yeah, the reality is that when you're a business owner today, you need to accept however way that your customer wants to pay. And certainly the pandemic has rapidly accelerated people's willingness to pay with digital forms of payment, whether it's QR codes or cards, etc. There was recent data that suggested that, you know, 25% of card transactions are now tapped. Now, that number was, you know, less than 5% pre-pandemic. So people's behavior have really changed, and therefore small business owners are following suit and are making sure that they can offer whatever payment service that their customers want to utilize. And you're right. We have seen, our data shows that basket sizes increase, level of sales rate increase. You know, you simply don't have to turn any customers away and send them to an ATM. A lot can happen between the point of purchase and going to go draw cash from an ATM. So it just makes a ton of sense. Linked to that is the ability to then start accessing capital. And we have seen, for example, the customers of ours that have accessed cash advances, which they can do because we have sales data of theirs, and we know how they're growing, have grown even faster as a result of their ability to tap into that sort of facility, as an example.
This idea of a cash advance, I mean, I sell biscuits on a Saturday morning, let's say door-to-door or at my local market, whatever the case might be, and you could see that I generate 10,000 rands worth of income every weekend. If I need money for flour and butter and eggs, do you put eggs in biscuits? I don't know. Flour and butter anyway, and I need that on a Friday. I can come to you and I say, listen, I need 5 grand for flour and butter, and you can look at the data of my last month or 6 months worth of performance, and you can see whether or not I'm going to be good for it to pay you back on Monday.
Exactly. In fact, it's even better than that. It's actually pre-approved for you. So we have been watching your data for some time. As you've been with us, we've pre-approved you for certain cash advance amounts. You know the entire amount that needs to be paid back. There is no term to that. We take a percentage of all the sales. So if you grow faster, you pay us back faster. If your sales slow down, you pay us back slower. But the truth is that we have the information, and therefore you can tap into that advance, and it can be in your bank account within 24 hours. And that is the advantage of this digital footprint and this sort of history of sales, which starts forming when you start utilizing these forms of services and payments.
The world is changing for the good from that perspective. Matt Brownell, thank you, the head of brand marketing at Yoco. Listening to that, Gerard Papenfuss, who's chief executive at the National Employers Association of South Africa. And you've come out today with a big statement talking about getting people into work and getting jobs going. There are no jobs. So getting people, young people, to start their own enterprises, Gerard. And I mean, I just listen to the guys at Yoco and I get very excited about the possibility of getting more people to run their own enterprises. What is it that you're actually going to be offering?
The aim is to expose young people to entrepreneurship. And we'll be using tax money, money that will otherwise go to SARS, is invested in this, it is a services theater project. And we found a service provider that's doing the IT around this. So the money is paid over to this particular company, which is working with us. We present this whole drive to the market. They utilize a portion of that for the training purposes. So this thing has got two elements. One is the training, entrepreneur training, and the other one is the practical side. So a portion is utilized for the training. The training happens per smartphone. Everything, that's one condition of participating in a scheme, is you must have a smartphone, because you get trained on the smartphone and you're assessed on that smartphone. Then a portion of the money goes towards the individual, a young person, as a stipend for him to live on. And the third portion is seed capital. That money is the utilization of that money is limited. You can only spend the money on the project which you want to engage in. So the young person, it needs to be an unemployed person between the ages of 18 and 28, gets training, learning, taught the basics of entrepreneurship. And then he buys and sells, or whatever he wants to do. Now, the beautiful part of this is that a person can invest in a young person in his area via this arrangement. So your money isn't going towards a pit, bottomless pit. It is going back to your area. And you don't, as a businessman, you don't have to, apart from making this contribution, you don't have to deal with this young person at all. But preferably, you can also mentor that person and assist that person and associate with that person. It's a 12-month period. And one only hopes that in that 12-month period, the young person grasps the essence of entrepreneurship. And it gets him underway. We just don't have the jobs for 64% of our young people.
No, but that is the problem. It's It is the problem. I mean, and how is there going to be sort of, what's going to be the barrier to entry in terms of this course? I mean, can anybody do it? Does how do you assess who qualifies and who doesn't? Because you also don't want to be extending it to people who don't have a chance of making it work.
Well, you know what? I don't think everybody will work, but there's in terms of the agreement with the CETAs, there's four conditions. Unemployed, between the ages of 18 and 28, you must have a grade 10, and you must have a smartphone. And then you, for you to get your stipend, you must do two things. You must trade, and you must study. So that's the thing. So it's not, you know, money just going towards a young person and that young person is not making a contribution. That is, he's constantly assessed on his performance, on the study side, the academic side, so to speak. And then he must trade, and that is monitored all the time. So, that's a wonderful opportunity for businesses. So let us help young people in our town. And, you know, it almost sounds too good to be true to say, you know, I can use money.
Exactly. I just wonder, we've got so many disparate activities happening. I mean, we talked to Nick Haralambos, for example, who's running a website called slowhustle.org, and he's raised some funding, and he's training individuals one at a time and giving them 5,000 rand to start a tiny micro enterprise, and he's got some fantastic stories of success, and I think a lot of those people are going to fly and succeed into the future. The Yes for Youth campaign, for example, the Yes campaign, has found some traction finally. More than 60,000 people have been helped through schemes. This feels as if it's linked and associated somehow, but this operation in silos, are we not sort of, are we going to achieve as much as we could if we collaborated more?
You know what, it may be, but you know, it may be silos, that is true, but a person that just happens to be falling in this category, in this particular silo, well, that is true. And there will be people falling out, but there will be persons making it, and there are already people making it, and there are already wonderful little stories of young people finding a way to make money in an area. You know, I just talked about one today that's his job is to go to shops for old women, old gogos, so to speak, that just cannot do it. And he asked them 9 rand to go and buy groceries. 9 rand.
Yeah,
but you know what? If you do it for 10, then you've got your 500 rand, and you do it 900 rand a day already, and you constantly do it. Go out, buy the stuff, and bring it back. And he bought himself a bicycle. Now, you know, great business people start exactly that way. So I think there's so much potential in this thing. I'm very, very excited.
Nkhara, thank you very much indeed. And Chief Executive of the National Employers Association of South Africa, doing a lot of good work, really doing a lot of good work, and it's exciting. And it's not money for nothing. I mean, it is money for considerable sweat equity back in order to make these micro enterprises work. It's what Nick's doing, it's what Nkhara is and his organization are now doing, and many, many others too, of course, in South Africa. And that is a very good, important and positive development as we desperately try to find ways to get people to earn their own incomes.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
This is not market related, but it is an investment story, and it's a US-based company called Vantage Data Centers. It's going to invest more than 15 billion rand, $1 billion, in its first African campus in Johannesburg. And it is it issued a statement saying that it's going to generate its own electricity. It's going to have 60,000 square meters of data space, 3 facilities across Joburg once it's fully developed, making it the largest in Africa. And the first phase of the campus will be completed by the third quarter of next year, which is really, really good news. And the company is saying, it's a guy called Antoine Boniface, the president of Vantage EMEA, saying that Johannesburg is the data center hub for sub-Saharan Africa due to its strategic location, IT ecosystem, fiber connectivity to the rest of Africa, availability of renewable energy. So, yeah, good stuff is happening. Small, isolated pockets of Good stuff. Chris Stewart, Portfolio Manager at 91. Not too much good stuff on the markets. I mean, a dearth of news and a market that scratched out the tiniest of gains, but back above the 66,000 for whatever that is worth, Chris Stewart.
Yes, good evening, Bruce. And even scratching out small gains looked a little bit unlikely earlier on in the day, so I guess we'll take it. As you indicate, there's a distinct lack of corporate news at the moment. Most of the companies with a September period end haven't yet reported. Most of the companies with a June period end or have already done so. We're in a slightly quiet patch in the market. We're seeing the U.S. third quarter report starting to come through. J.P. Morgan, the bellwether banking stock, reporting in the U.S. this afternoon. Locally, we've seen, I guess, retail sales data being the highlight or low light of the day, depending on how you'd like to look at that. And then the all-important U.S. inflation numbers, which were out this afternoon as well.
Talk to me about those inflation numbers, because that's what's driving sentiment around the world at the moment. It seems like they were undershot the expectations quite significantly, because we did suddenly see a turnaround in the currency.
Yeah, I mean, U.S. inflation did disappoint again slightly. Market expectations for U.S. CPI to come in at 5.3% month on month for the month of September, and it came in at 5.4%, so just a fraction higher. And, you know, the market is nervous about inflationary pressures building up across the world, nervous about the extent to which that will precipitate monetary normalization. I'm not going to call it monetary tightening, but monetary normalization, a sense that we are, you know, going to see tapering start in the U.S. Next month. And I guess there's an increasing likelihood that we could see a 25 basis point rate hike here in South Africa next month. That's got risk assets certainly nervous. But if I look at the U.S., it's kind of trading in and out of the black at the moment. So, you know, equity markets taking their stride. There's been no major reaction from the U.S. 10-year bonds either. So a slightly poor inflation number, but not a disastrous inflation number. And I guess locally, if you look at the data we've seen today, the retail sales numbers coming out today, also a slightly disappointing number, missing expectations with retail growth. Looking pretty muted, and there's a lot of factors to consider. There's base effects in that there were elevated numbers last year, particularly in certain areas of the economy that benefited from lockdown. Those are coming out of the base. We've also had, I guess, some of the rollover impacts of the civil unrest of July and August that's still probably impacting retail sales to a degree. But we are seeing a general downward trend relative to 2019 pre-COVID retail sales level, but also perhaps a little bit more concerning, a downtrend relative to earlier on this year. It does feel as though some of the sort of retail pulse, the consumer pulse that we saw coming out of the hard lockdown of last year is starting to abate. And if you combine that with increasing interest rates on the horizon, and it makes it for a slightly tough environment in terms of a strong retail recovery, I would argue.
Thank you, Chris Stewart. He's a portfolio manager at 91. Also making reference today to that violence in July, a trading statement for 6 months to the end of August from Famous Brands, which has had huge problems, of course, in many of its operations, particularly in the United Kingdom, where they wrote off 1.3 billion rand, an impairment in the United Kingdom as a result of its investment in something called Gourmet Burger Kitchen. And so that was in the last set of results, and these results are going to be flattered by the fact that they look much better than the results the year before. But operationally, says Famous Brands today, across our trading markets, South Africa, rest of Africa, Middle East, and the United Kingdom, negative financial impact of COVID-19 continues to weigh heavily. The civil unrest experienced in South Africa materially impacted the group's results. The group's performance recovered in varying degrees across our trading markets from the pandemic's worst financial impacts compared to the prior comparable period. So it's not a sunny outlook at all in the fast food market, which has always been a fairly resilient market, particularly in South Africa, as consumer spending has been quite robust for long periods of time. But without that strong consumer spending and with the added impacts of violence and those sorts of things, things certainly weighing very heavily on firms like Famous Brands.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
It's interesting looking around the world at a lot of places that many South Africans are considering emigrating to, and it's an anecdotal set of data, of course. You try and get accurate numbers from Home Affairs, you try and get accurate numbers from SARS, and they are nigh impossible to come to. But just lots of stories today on Britain's jobs crisis, where there are a huge number of companies in the United Kingdom desperate to hire new staff, and they're seeing that at a record high, and they're saying there is an abject shortage of skilled workers, and it's actually stunting the UK recovery. Now, a lot of that is self-imposed through Brexit and the exclusion of immigration and a tightening up on that particular front in the United Kingdom. But in the United States, on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, 4.3 million people quit their jobs in the US in August, and that's according to data from the Labor Department. And it's a huge amount. I mean, it is the most on record. It's about 3% of the workforce just quit their jobs. 892,000 workers left restaurants, bars and hotels. 721,000 left retail. 706,000 left their jobs in professional business services. More than 500,000 in healthcare and social assistance. Just went this far and no further. I don't want this job anymore, and walked away. Why? Well, in the United States, jobs are so plentiful and the people required to fill them are so scarce that suddenly workers are beginning to find themselves with far more opportunity, far more leverage. And if they're finding the jobs that they're doing are just too stressful, or they've got too many hours for low pay, the natural thing is you chuck it in and you go somewhere where you're going to be appreciated more. That is the way the jobs market should work. In South Africa, we don't have those sorts of opportunities because we don't have the sort of skill shortage that is we don't have the jobs, basically, that our skills can fill. And that's a desperate situation. So instead of making the economy more productive and growing to create the opportunity, we go on strike to demand more. And it's just a perverse arrangement that we have. It really is. And in countries that are growing sustainably, the real problem is we can't find enough jobs. Wouldn't that be a glorious problem for South Africa, to not have enough workers to fill the positions that we had available and having to import skills from elsewhere? That would be brilliant. On the next Money Show, personal finance expert and published author for a third time, Warren Ingram, talking to us about how you know the risk of your investments. Also talking about some innovative ways of managing retirement money. Then Pavlo Fotidis with small business and getting some really good advice for you. And Nick Haralambos, of course, throwing cash at micro enterprises as we talk side hustles every Thursday night on The Money Show.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, highlighting the need to sustainably recharge global finance at Cybos 2021. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. It is good to be with you on this Wednesday evening. Boris Johnson is an extraordinary fish. I read with interest his biography that he wrote. And a compelling story, and a really good writer is Boris Johnson. He was a journalist, of course, covering the European Union and many other issues as a younger man. But here he is on holiday on the island of Marbella on the coast of Spain. And he is constantly, and his book on Winston Churchill is the biggest praise-singing initiative of Winston Churchill, who by any stretch of the imagination was a remarkable individual. But Boris Johnson's adoration of Churchill and his ability to lead Britain in crisis, I think, has led Johnson to take Britain into the crisis that it faces at the moment, and desperately going into this sort of Churchillian mode. Now, on holiday, pictures have been taken, long lens pictures of him at this billionaire's pad in Marbella, and he's got an easel out, and he's got a canvas out, and he is painting in white overalls. he is channeling Winston Churchill all over again. It's gone beyond a spoof. It is a deliberate attempt to create the imagery of Churchill. Churchill was a great wartime leader, of course, who, once the crisis was over, the war, he was voted out of office and Clement Attlee came in and became the Prime Minister of Britain to head up a Labour government. And that was the origins of what is still an enormously successful National Health Service. But Boris Johnson, just an extraordinary individual, really an extraordinary individual, who looks to be deliberately challenging the history of Winston Churchill in some sort of perverse idea that he is comparable as a leader in crisis, I suspect.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
These retail sales numbers read like hieroglyphics to me. They really do. Retail sales bounced back, measured in real terms and constant 2015 prices. Other, just too many numbers and too confusing. Let's get some analysis on it. Sipamandla Mkwanazi is a senior FNB economist. No matter how you look at these numbers, Sipamandla, I mean, we are, the retail sector in South Africa is taking a huge amount of strain.
Good evening, Bruce. Good evening to your listeners. Yes, I think the August numbers point out a couple of things. Number one, that the sector is still suffering from the hangover from the riots. I think that the affected workers would have spent cautiously after those riots, and those that participated in the looting would have found very little need to go buy some groceries in August. So that's the first part. But I think the broader part is what it indicates about the strength of demand. I think that it is telling us something about the lack of employment creation. So demand is just relatively muted. We did see some improvement in some segments, but overall it just suggests that there's just weak demand at this stage.
And that's what makes the market's expectation of a rate hike in November really hard to fathom. Explain to me why it is, when demand is as weak as it is, that the Reserve Bank is contemplating raising interest rates. Because it is a technical reason, it is a complicated reason, but it's an important thing to understand.
It is an important thing to understand. One of the factors that they look at is what they call the output gap, so potential minus, so actual minus potential GDP. Now, if underlying demand is low, and one of the ways that one can look at just the strength of underlying demand is to look at core inflation. So inflation, having removed the volatile items such as food and oil and electricity. Now, if you look at that inflation rate, it's sitting at around 3%. So closer to the lower band of the lower target band, indicative of low demand. Now, when it comes to interest rate decision, it is one of the factors that they look at. Just looking at the output gap. Now, with these numbers suggesting these low levels of demand, it means that it's one of the factors that would you would use to argue against an increase in interest rate, because underlying demand is just very low.
So I look at this November decision and I wonder whether or not it can be pushed through with any sort of degree of public acceptance. I mean, nobody likes an interest rate increase. We prefer lower interest rates unless, of course, you live on income from your capital. But that's very few people nowadays. I'm wondering how the Reserve Bank is going to sell the need for this rate hike in a simple enough way for us to understand, based on the fact that this economy is on life support and the Lesetša Ganyago does not want to be standing on the oxygen pipe in ICU.
No, so if you just look at what is happening to very little.
And we've lost Sipamandla. Let's not worry about that, Sipamandla. Sipamandla Mkwanazi, senior FNB economist, on the line to us from Johannesburg. The curse of the 10-7 phone call.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter @BruceBusiness.
I follow Lisa Illingworth on LinkedIn. She's the chief executive of Future Proof South Africa. And I see your posts of spending time in classes, talking to kids about entrepreneurship, about businesses, about the magic of starting up your own enterprise. And I find it hugely inspiring. But today, a different tone, Lisa. You said we've been working with students at Curo Helderwijk this term, and I'm taking the holidays to prepare their reports. The school has opted to introduce entrepreneurial studies as an elective subject for the first time. And so at the end of each term, the learners, I hate that word, will get this kind of feedback. Is this the first time that Curo has introduced into the curriculum as an elective subject entrepreneurship? Are you beginning to get some traction there?
Yeah, Bruce, I think this is the first time that I know of that it's been introduced outside of what the government is trying to do in embedding entrepreneurship into the curriculum. They're running a pilot that has been running for about 8 years. But this is the first time, as far as I know, that it's actually being embedded at an independent school.
And that's brilliant. And they've asked you then to come in and to teach this as well. What are you offering in terms of this course? It's not the school curriculum. They don't get marks for it. But you are creating, hopefully, a buzz and a sense of anticipation.
I would hope so. I think the curriculum that we follow is custom built. It's based on best practice from Babson University, from Kaufman Foundation, from the Erasmus Institute, which are all global organizations in entrepreneurship education. But then we've panel beated it down into something that works in a blended economy. So we don't teach kids from the outset to go and look for funding, because in our economy, that is setting them up for failure. We teach them how to bootstrap off the bat. And those are the kinds of things that we're doing with these kids, how to prototype, how to find an MVP, and then how to do the lean startup method in getting their business going, but then taking into consideration the environmental factors and the economy that they're going to have to deal with once their businesses are started.
What sort of response do you get in the classroom?
We get an interesting response. A lot of the kids that come, they sort of say they're not used to being taught like this. And in fact, that was the response from one of the educators sitting in. She said, the kids are not used to being taught like this, where there is no wrong. The right answer is there is none. You have to go and figure it out and test and assume and enjoy the process of learning, because that's what entrepreneurship is about. It's not a system of stop and goes like the way the school curriculum is built.
And this is, again, this idea of scaling the lessons that we learn. And I wonder just how scalable what it is that you're doing here is, so that you can maybe go to government with its 8-year pilot project. I don't know if I'd want to fly in a plane with somebody who's been training for 8 years. How can we scale this and actually create a curriculum that gets into the schooling system that is teachable and learnable?
Yeah. So the curriculum that we built was crafted about, between 7 and 8 years ago, around the same time that pilot went into schools. And it's crafted on the basis of an outcomes-based curriculum, which is practiced around the world in terms of embedding behavior. And entrepreneurship is bedded down in behavior and traits and characteristics, and sorely we lack that in our curriculum. So the curriculum is there. The academic structure is there. Scalability, well, that's often, where we start talking about exponential organizations and we start looking at being able to bring tech in to be able to scale that. So the online learning system that we've got has given us that functionality. In fact, we've run courses for teachers in Kenya and some programs for kids in Slovakia. So we've done some very cool stuff that gives us the indication that there is scalability. Unfortunately, the Department of Education suffers from a mindset of not made here. So it's very, very difficult, because we've had these conversations, to get into that sort of structure, because the idea is, well, it's not made here. And with that, the conversation stops. So instead of trying to fight the wheels and turn the national narrative, we're just getting stuck into doing the work.
Lisa Illingworth, a depressing way to finish, but a really important progress being made. Chief Executive at Future Proof South Africa, again, widening the gap between private schools and privileged schools and government schools who don't have access to this information.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, of course, brings you The Money Show each and every single day, bringing trade, finance, cash management and investor solutions to Cybos 2021, the bravery to imagine. That's Africa Nacity. APSA is a registered FSP. If you want somebody to help you find a needle in a haystack, can I recommend that you chat to none other than Wendy Nola? Wendy has spent much of this week trying to track down what should be easily accessible, and that is a recorded conversation between a customer and a financial services provider. Whenever you go into these conversations with financial services providers, they tell you that the call has been recorded for quality purposes. They tell you that it is also and will be legally binding if you make if you have come to any agreement with them in that phone call, and off you embark on this particular discussion. And it came from a complaint that we reflected on last week, and the complainant had applied for a holiday, a COVID holiday, a payment holiday, that's what they called, and it was a 3-month payment holiday, and then they would resume their payments soon after that. Now, the financial services provider says that it provided all of the information required for the customer to make an informed decision. They agreed based on that information that had been provided, and therefore the length of their term, and I forget the numbers, but they are insane, has been extended. The amount of money that they're going to have to pay back over the length of this particular contract is extraordinary. And Wendy Nola has been doggedly pursuing the phone call between the call center and the customer. And she's going to be updating on that, us on that in the next 20 minutes, in the next 15 minutes even. That's coming up in a few minutes' time.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
With Colin Cullis.
Business Unusual brought to you by Workforce Staffing. How does one turn disruption into innovation? By using Workforce Staffing's scalable and agile staffing solutions. That's how. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual. I remember writing a news headline probably at the end of 1997 or early in January 1998. And the news headline was, China is our new best friend. And I thought to myself, I felt very smug about that, so smug that I still remember it to this day, because as a kid, all my toys, Colin, were made in Taiwan. And today, I ordered a bunch of stuff to help me write my new book. There was a mouse, a keypad, a proper chair, all sorts of stuff like that, all made in China. Because this is a story about Taiwan, but it is also a story about China, which wants Taiwan to be back in the family, bada boom, bada bing, sort of mafia style, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's a great summary, Bruce, because I think for most people, our understanding, our experience, unless we've actually been to China or Taiwan or have read up and studied, the situations, the history of those two countries, is the things we consume that come from them. And they are both massive economic, creators of products that we consume. And it's kind of unfortunate that we sometimes have such a simplistic view of the history and what is actually going on, certainly as the conflict in that region and between those two countries does seem to be notching up to a point where a lot of people are taking notice, and quite a few are expressing concern that, you know, what happens next could have major implications, not just for the people of China and Taiwan, but the whole region and invariably the globe. And, you know, in looking at the conflict that is there and how it came about, it's way more complex than certainly, most people will know. And in my trying to read up a little bit, and I have to stress again, I have the most superficial understanding after my attempt of the last couple of days to try and understand a little bit more, really leaves you, stuck a bit with saying anybody who can glibly tell you it's simple, we should just do this. The only thing it illustrates is they don't understand what's at stake. However, there is sometimes an opportunity where seeing the bigger picture maybe is the best solution. And I'm sure you've come across this notion of the overview effect, which is ascribed by psychologists, particularly to people who have been to space, that for all the trouble you have in your life, all the trouble you're aware of in your country and your region and the world, as soon as you just leave the planet and get enough perspective to be able to see the entire thing, our view of it changes. And I was looking to try and find some context for this evening's conversation for understanding that this is something where you've got to look close and understand the details, but also have that distance to understand the bigger picture. And I got it delivered to me quite surprisingly because William Shatner, Captain Kirk, happened to be on the Blue Origin flight that went to space a little earlier today. Well, went to the Kármán line. Some people will debate if he went to space. And upon his return, most of the guys on the crew and certainly the people who welcomed them back, it was a successful launch and landing, were, you know, shooting champagne and shouting and celebrating. But William Shatner had a very profound overview effect. And there happened to be cameras near enough to him. And Jeff Bezos, when he walked over to him to say, how's it going? He wasn't on the flight. He was sort of their special chaperone. Saw William Shatner start just talking for minutes and minutes about the profound effect it had on him. I've tried to capture a minute of it. I'm mindful that there is a lot of noise because they've just landed and people are celebrating around him. But if you can, just try and listen to the way he speaks. William Shatner is a pretty good, coherent speaker. But listen to the emotion in his voice that really, I think, epitomizes what happens with the overview effect and the impression it does leave on someone.
Everybody needs to see the instant.
Oh, my God.
It was unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, you know, the little things, the weightlessness. But to see the blue cover go whip by, and now you're staring into blackness. That's the thing. The covering of blue, this sheet, this blanket, this comforter of blue that we have around us. We think, oh, that's blue sky. And then suddenly you shoot through it all of a sudden, as though you whip off a sheet off you when you're asleep, and you're looking into blackness, into black ugliness. And you look down, and there's the blue down there.
Okay, Colin, it's very noisy and very distracting, but we get a sense of the emotion, of course, of William Shatner talking about what you see from space and this whipping off the blanket, of course, and seeing the blue, and it's glorious. And you can hear that his voice is thick with emotion. It really is lovely, isn't it?
It was, and I suppose him now being the oldest person to have ever been to space at 90, you know, there's another perspective he has for getting closer to saying, how much time will I have to see this magical blue marble and enjoy all its wonders upon it? Which, you know, for the rest of us, when we're stuck in our details of our lives, forget that it is like that tiny little film that separates us from the blackness of space. The shortness of our lives is something similar. And that hopefully is a bit of a context, maybe not too much of an over elaborate one, for just having a look at the situation that is happening between China and Taiwan. And my starting point was simply trying to say, the way I got into this is somebody had asked online, how many countries are they? I thought that was a pretty simple question. And I figured all you needed to know was, well, there is an answer. And once you know the answer, you just need to remember it. And then you tell somebody the answer is X. But it is unfortunately more complex because it depends who you're asking and it depends which body is counting the countries. So generally speaking, the United Nations is probably the body that would take the greatest credit for saying, right, these are the countries of the world looking to manage what is going on. And by their count, there is 193. And I mention them in particular because their count excludes Taiwan. Only 14 countries on the planet, and there are at least 193 now, as you would know, do count Taiwan as a country. Most count China as a country and Taiwan as a currently unincorporated part of China. And the history for how it got there and why it is so perplexing and so important for China to want to get Taiwan back, and why at the moment, despite not everybody in Taiwan, you know, not wanting to rejoin China, is at an inflection point for saying, well, maybe we don't have to anymore. Maybe it's not such a big deal. So I thought I'd start with a little bit of history. And again, super, super brief history, just to give some sense as to how we got to now, which hopefully makes understanding what might happen next a little more, give it a little more context. So Taiwan was is a large island. It's off China, about 100 kilometers off of the mainland. But there wasn't much happening there. The people had been living there for 6,000 years. But the first time somebody tried to settle it and make something of it was, surprise, surprise, Dutch colonists back in the sort of 17th century. And they built up a bit of a port for their own benefit to extract what they could from the region. And it was only when a dynasty had fallen in mainland China, and some of the people from that dynasty had fled across to Taiwan, Formosa then, named by the Portuguese as this beautiful island, that mainland China had said, well, we got to go and finish this off. And so went and took over the sort of base that the Dutch were running, and then ran it as if it was part of China for a good many years, until Japan decided that it was feeling a little expansionist as it was, and it took it over. And rather than the way most colonial countries have tended to deal with taking over countries, you know, you go in, you extract what you want, but you're not really too fussed with the people who live there. Japan went in and sought to make it part of Japan, so they enforced the learning of Japan, the wearing of Japanese dress, etc., and added quite a bit of infrastructure as well, almost to the point that while people living in Taiwan would not have been grateful for what Japan had imposed on them, they had actually started moving ahead economically and certainly developmentally from what mainland China was at that point. And that changed again after the end of the Second World War, where the Allies had effectively said Japan is not entitled to keep any of the regions that it held, and handed it back to the then nationalist Chinese authority. They had subsequently overthrown their last dynasty, the Qing dynasty, in the early 1900s, and it went to this nationalist, still authoritarian, not necessarily the greatest sort of governance system in the world, which, as a consequence of not being a very good system and it being kind of weak, led to the rise of the Communist Party, who effectively had a civil war and chased what was left of the nationalists of that government, who took refuge in Taiwan, calling it sort of a temporary base until they could retake the rest of China. And this is where this crazy notion of China saying Taiwan is part of China, and Taiwan, certainly parts of Taiwan, believing that China was part of Taiwan, as it were, the People's Republic of China, which most people refer to as China, and then supposedly the Republic of China, which, you know, typically is Taiwan. So now you have this sort of standoff between these two, and communist China was certainly looking to say, well, look, we're going to go and finish the job. We're going to pop across and deal with what's there. Certainly the people who were living in Taiwan would have had no problems had the communists done that, because the nationalist Chinese who came there, the island had about 6 million residents, about 2 million came from mainland China, and effectively set up a crony system, very authoritarian, with scant regard for what the locals wanted or how they saw their governance working. But if it weren't for a war in Korea with, the issues between a communist North and backing of Russia, and the Americans not wanting to see South Korea becoming communist, America decided to intervene in China's then plans simply to retake Taiwan and held that they would defend Taiwan in order to keep another non-communist ally. So two in a row, we've got colonial powers and, you know, international interventions just muddying the waters and making things a lot more complicated than need to be. And so it lasted effectively up till now, with Taiwan itself actually becoming quite loathsome of what that nationalist regime was doing in the country, despite in the 70s and 80s, there was an economic boom throughout the region. China had become much more of a useful ally, as it were, for America. And at that point, America had said, we acknowledge that China does have a right to get the reunification going, and so agreed to support China's as the central country, and Taiwan would be, you know, sort of a secondary part of it, and many other of their allies joined with that. But in the 90s, things changed, because Taiwan themselves decided to overthrow this authoritarian one-party state, to embrace democracy, to start making massive improvements, not just with the democratic front, but socially. They've become a lot more progressive. Their economy had opened up. They became hugely innovative. And took off, as you know, this is where we were saying everything was made in Taiwan. This is the period in the early 90s that they managed to get there. And while it's been a seesaw the whole time between how do we reunify and which parties are in favor and which parties are against, the tipping point probably came in the last 2 years, with China ramping up its need to or want to reunify. The practices in Hong Kong, where it was supposed to be, you know, one China, two systems, and it appearing that, you know, China didn't really abide by the two systems, pretty much enforcing its rule and its way of wanting to do things in Hong Kong, that Taiwan is now certainly a lot more worried. And the question then becomes, and I know we don't have time, so online I will leave you the various scenarios as to what could play out. Suffice to say, some of them could be, this is just a big storm in a teacup, possibly a big distraction for other challenges that China has got to do with how it's been handling local conditions regarding flooding, massive issues with regards to its property system and Evergrande's defaults and things related to that, the issues it's had with clipping the wings of its tech giants and looking for something, a nationalist cause to say, let's refocus our attention over there, versus Xi Jinping's own legacy. He's 68 and has committed when he took over to say, I'm going to see this through. to want to sort of make this part of his legacy, to say, I was the person who not just led this massive economic improvement in China, but I was the one who finally, you know, completed the puzzle for history to make China this one country again. And so we're left with this moving part with lots of other players, you know, America's role, Europe's role, which is not necessarily the same as America, Australia now part of the mix, Japan and how it will do it, Russia, etc. Everybody's involved, including South Africa, has been pretty strong allies of China. To see what's going to happen. And so I would simply encourage everybody that this is a fascinating subject and a frightening one in some respects. And so us all doing a little more, understanding a little more might help that should our voices need to be lent, or possibly some pressure need to be brought to bear for peaceful measures, for whatever else, that hopefully we're prepared and ready and able to do so.
Colin Cullis, that sage warning this evening. Thank you very much. The future of Taiwan very much in China's crosshairs. And of course, Business Unusual, brought to you by Workforce Staffing. With pandemics, load shedding and political unrest, disruptions are a reality of any growing business. South Africa's leading staffing and recruitment provider understands that flexible workforce is critical as external interruptions become the norm. For support with agile and compliant employment services, visit workforcestaffing.co.za today.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja. I teed it up a little earlier, but let me summarize. You told us last week of a lady who contacted you. Her name is Indira, and she'd taken out a loan via Direct Access, which is part of Sanlam, for 60 months in 2019. And when COVID hit, she realized that she would not be able to pay back the loan as per the agreement. So she asked for and accepted a payment holiday of 6 months, and that seemed all nice and rosy. But what it's done is extended her payment term extraordinarily, and also the amount of money that she's going to have to pay back. And what we were trying to do last week was trying to find out whether or not she had a legitimate contract between herself and Sanlam's Direct Access. What have you managed to find?
Okay, it was a bit of a slip to find anything out at all, I have to say. But so I asked her to apply for the call recording, and she's was told yes, that'll be fine. I was told this by Sanlam's advertising agency, the agency that handles their PR in some cases. And they got back to me this week to say, we played it to her over the phone on Friday. And I said, well, that's well and good, but could you please also send her own copy so that she could listen to the recording of the call in her own time, on her own terms? Yes, yes, we'll do that. Turns out, when I checked with Indira, she hadn't had that call. She hadn't listened to Tuesday.
Sorry, so the public relations company employed by Sanlam lied to you.
Well, I'll get there. So she said, okay. So I went back to them and said, and also they said, in order to send her the call recording, she needs to fill out this form. It's called the Request for Access to Record of Private Body form, okay? And she hadn't done it. So I get back to her. She says, first of all, I've never heard the call recording. That call to play it never happened. And secondly, I sent the form back, as they asked, filled in on Friday to the legal department. So I don't know what they're talking about. So I go back to Sanlam's person, third-party media complaints handling person. Oh, I'll get back to you. Gets back to me yesterday afternoon. No, that was a misunderstanding. Sorry about that. We didn't play it to her. Sorry. We'll chase up. Anyway, eventually today, they sent her the call. She shared it with me. And what wanted to establish, Bruce, was how much they disclosed in terms of the impact. Because what this happened was it added, she took initially 3 months, and then she took another 3 months to 6 months. That was the maximum. And the first 3 month call, the first call about the 3 months, they didn't say how many months it was going to add. It didn't say to her term. They didn't say, so instead of paying this much in total for your holiday, for your loan, you're going to pay this much, which in her case was, I don't know, it was almost as much as the original loan, more, 118,000 rand more. So this is how the call went. It took 2 minutes. We'll just take 2 minutes. And this is what the agent said. It'll be for 3 months starting from your next debit order, which means you do not have to make a loan repayment for 3 months. Repayments will resume in month 4, an original loan agreement installment. This was read very fast like this. Interest and fees will still be charged on the outstanding balance for the 3 month payment relief period at the current contractual interest rate. The original term of your loan agreement will be extended to accommodate the temporary payment relief period and to ensure that the monthly repayment remains the same.
Hold on a second. So, yes, the term will be extended to ensure that the amount of the payment remains the same. Now, is that sufficient disclosure which says that we are going to charge you the same amount of money, but over many, many more months? And therefore,
yes,
the total amount that you're going to pay us, because, I mean, I haven't been into a furniture retail shop for a very long time, but there was a point where, you know, the furniture retailers had to disclose that, you know, you buy this couch, here's the price, 10,000, you pay back, you know, 299 rand a month over the rest of your life, and the final, by the time you finish paying for this couch, it'll be worn out, and you would have spent 20,000 rand. There was that sort of requirement to disclose every single detail of the transaction. Does that not apply in these very bored call center operators' lives?
I certainly think so. I've got a big issue with telesales calls or anything conducted over the phone where, you know, things are read, the important things are read very fast. When the agent said, got to the part where she said the term will be extended. As she said the word term, there was I think it was Indira who coughed, or there was some noise. And I'm sure she didn't. When I checked with her earlier, I said, "Did you even hear the word term extension?" She said, "No." So there was no, "Do you understand?" There was no meeting of the minds. To me, it was very clear. She just said, "Do you agree?" And she said, "Yes." And at some point, she must have extended it by another 3 months. So I don't feel that she was making an informed decision there at all. And I mean, down the line, she's now discovered, you know, exactly what this means. Another 20 months, another, it's 61,600 rand more than she would have. So those 6 months of non-payment were very, very expensive. And yes, you could say that she should have known that. But I feel the exact, certainly initially when it was going to be just 3 months payment holiday, the exact numbers, what it would mean, what it was going to cost her in rand numbers, I feel there was a duty to disclose that. And as I say, it took so long to get the recording that I haven't had a chance to go back and say to the company, listen, what are you going to do about this? And so that's going to be part three, Bruce.
Okay, no,
what are you going to do about it?
No, that's great. I mean, I love the drama that we're serializing one person's two-minute phone call over half an hour of radio
exactly.
In 3 weeks. Wendy, what is the legitimacy of that agreement over the phone? Surely there's a document that gets sent that spells
yes.
out the consequences that you
yes.
sign and return, surely or not.
Funny you should mention that. So the agent says, we're just going to run through this. I'm just going to highlight. That was a word. I'm just going to highlight how this works, and then we're going to send you an email. So at the end of her 2 minute spiel, and fast forward, you know, WhatsApp, when you press the 1.5, it sounded like that. Voice note I'm talking about. She then says, I want to confirm your email address. I want you to confirm your email address. So Indira starts reading it out and she says, that's not what we've got here. She was giving her current business address, email address. So the woman, so Indira says, well, there's also my personal Gmail address, and she reads it out and the woman says, oh, that's fine. That's what I've got here. But Indira never got the email, and they acknowledged that because they told her it bounced back. Now they've got her cell phone number. Nobody phoned her to say, we couldn't send you your these important documents via email. Could you give us an alternative address? So I think that was another fail. They should most definitely, given what was at stake here, they should have done that. But there is a point in that phone conversation where the agent says, please understand that once you've agreed to this, you can't cancel. So only afterwards do you get it all in writing.
But sure, what does... Once you agree to this, you can't cancel. Does that mean once you agree on this phone call where we've not disclosed all of the detail to you and we've not been completely transparent, but you've agreed to those terms and conditions because you're desperate, because you don't know whether you're going to have
exactly.
a job next month, or does the agreement mean once you've signed the document we send you and you email it back to us, that's when the agreement is enforced?
No.
I don't understand.
No, if that was the case, then they couldn't have applied this payment holiday because they didn't get that in writing. So that phone call becomes the consent. So I mean, sending the documents is just a formality, it would seem, contractually. It's quite a thing, Bruce. So the more I get into this, the more it throws up. So I'm afraid there is going to have to be a part.
No, absolutely. I'm looking forward to part three. Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, our dogged consumer ninja. We should have to get an extra long title, dogged consumer ninja. Where Wendy Nola, she is delving deep into this thing. And please, Direct Access, do expect a call from Wendy, because she's got your number, literally. And she's looking for some answers, and we would like those answers. I think producers, let's see how this plays out. Let's keep tabs on this, Wendy, and I look forward to catching up on installment number three on a 2-minute phone call that really does, at this stage, from what we know, seem to have been wholly inadequate.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, highlighting the need to sustainably recharge global finance at Cybos 2021. That's Africanacity. Absence of registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Do you find that more things are irritating you than perhaps used to? I certainly blame age for that. I mean, very few things anger me. I mean, there are a handful of things that really enrage me. A handful of things infuriate me. People littering angers me. It's not, you know, it's on the list of things that really annoy, because it's inevitable that whatever you dump on the street is going to get flushed into the water system. It's going to, in some form, whether it's in microparticles or whether it be in the form of whatever it was that you chucked onto the street, it'll end up in the ocean and ultimately get washed back onto the shore and affect sea life and destroy the planet. It's a catastrophic cycle. And somebody who's taken that annoyance to a new level is Ania Omardin, who is the founder and director of The Beach Co-op. Ania, what is The Beach Co-op?
Hi there. Good evening, everyone. So The Beach Co-op is a non-profit organization which really started as a volunteer group back in 2015 and then later got registered as a non-profit in 2017. And our vision is to connect ocean communities, government and business, and to create, collaborate and care to protect, restore and regenerate our coastal heritage. And we do that by hosting beach cleanups as one of the ways.
Why did you start? What was the catalyst for you going this far and no further?
It's a very interesting question. I worked for many years, close to 10 years, at WWF South Africa on the marine program, and I left when I was pregnant with my first son. Becoming a mother meant that became more or less my full-time job, but I wanted to give back to the place that I spent a lot of time at, and that was the beach with my kids. Eventually, kids. And so I reached out to a few of my ex-colleagues, and one of them was Professor Peter Ryan. And I wanted to find out how I could support or help any projects that were currently on the go in conservation. And the project that Peter suggested and recommended was one that spoke to my need to give back to my local surf break, really, which was Musenberg. Mm-hmm. And is Musenberg. And so he suggested that we started cleaning the rocky shore at Surface Corner because he's been doing research along our South African coastline for over 40 years. And he wanted to see what we would find in the rocky shore versus the sandy beaches, which he'd been studying. And that's really how the Beach Co-op started. And the heart of the Beach Co-op is a Surface Corner at Musenberg, and we still do regular new moon cleanups there, and we've done so for the last 6 years, actually.
I mean, it's wonderful, wonderfully satisfying for everybody who's involved. I'm sure it's very sociable. I'm sure it's very fulfilling to fill bags up with tons of stuff that people throw away. But it must be very tedious to be doing this almost like Groundhog Day on repeat and exactly the same stuff, washing up and you picking it up and putting it into the bags and taking it and disposing of it responsibly. Because yeah. you're dealing with the symptom, not the cause. And I know that that's a far bigger issue. What is your experience of these regular new moon cleanups and the way in which it goes on repeat?
Yeah, so what's actually been interesting is we've seen a difference at Surfers Corner because we've been cleaning it regularly for 6 years, every month, every new moon. But in addition to doing these new moon cleanups, we also have cleanups that happen on other beaches along our South African coastline, so not only in Cape Town. And what we encourage people to use is the Dirty Dozen methodology. And this, again, comes from Peter's research and him noticing some of these common items. So the Dirty Dozen is made up of things like plastic bags, straws, individual sweet wrappers, chip packets. So it's a way, it's a citizen science approach. And ultimately, we ask our participants to help us collect data. And so through this experiential learning process, we're hoping to change behavior and for people to become more aware and to purchase less single-use plastic when they're at the shop. So it's the tail end of the chain of custody, yes, but it's a means for individuals to feel that they can somehow contribute. And that's not to say that big businesses shouldn't be held accountable for producing what we end up finding on our beaches and in our waterways. But it certainly is one of the ways in which we can address and tackle this catastrophic problem.
I mean, it is, and it's a time bomb, and it's terrifying, and it's all of these various things. And a lot of people get absolutely enraged. And I think somewhere deep down, you are deeply enraged, despite your very calm and measured discussion on this issue, because you engage something that you call delicate activism. What is delicate activism?
It's an approach that I'm learning. It is an approach that I am using, and in a way, it's not to address things in a harsh, confrontational way, but to rather bring people along. And of course, you know, we live in South Africa. We have to engage with the fact that not everyone has access to beautiful beaches or the possibility of their waste actually being collected, and we need to work within that framework and try and bring people from diverse backgrounds along with us. Some people haven't had the opportunity to experience swimming or even enjoying an ocean space for that matter. So what we try and do at the Beach Co-op is also encourage this awe and awareness and understanding of how beautiful and biodiverse our marine environment is. So at our new moon cleanups, for example, sure, we do regular cleanups, but we encourage people to get lost and try and find different plants and animals and creatures whilst they go about cleaning. So we have our identity books alongside us, alongside the plastic bags and the reusable bags, to encourage people to also enjoy that space. And I really feel that through caring and for our marine environment and also getting lost in the wonder and awe, people will tend to then want to protect our marine environment. So that's how I describe delicate activism.
It's lovely, but I mean, in a country where activism is traditionally very loud and very shouty and can be a little bit destructive, you're opting for a softly approach. I want to find out from you in a moment how that works and how you see the results come by as a result of a very patient approach, a very understanding approach, a very inclusive approach, which over the long term I think has only got to be more successful. But the crisis is short term, the crisis is now. So how does that work more with our guest this evening? joining the founder and director of The Beach Co-op, Ania Omardin, this evening on the line to us from Cape Town.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, highlighting the need to sustainably recharge global finance at Cybos 2021. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Ania Omardin has got the ocean in her blood. She's the founder and director of the Beach Co-op, and it emerged as a result of her wanting to help improve the environment which she loves and which she was taking her children to, but finding increasingly polluted. And so a collaborative effort to get this idea of a collaborative approach, this delicate activism. And does it work better than Thabo Mbeki's quiet diplomacy did in Zimbabwe, Ania?
So getting back to delicate activism and why I've chosen to work in this way, really for me, the traditional way conservation has been done in South Africa, I feel hasn't really worked either. And that's mainly to have people out and not involved in a collaborative way at all. And so, yes, it takes time and it takes longer, but I think it's definitely bringing people along that will hopefully result in a cleaner environment and in a stewardship, the ownership of our hydro commons in this case, something that is a common resource that we all share and that we all benefit from, is important. So, you know, at the Beach Co-op, we tend to work with artists. We've done quite a bit of work with Claire Homewood at some of our tidal pools here in False Bay to share the knowledge of what we're seeing in our tidal pools and have them depicted along the wall. We've got a new one coming out in November, hopefully, with some of the rocky shore life that we find at Surface Corner. We work with poets, currently working with Tony Giselle Stewart on a poem for COP26, actually, and trying to understand how, you know, plastic pollution and making that connection between fossil fuel emission and then also this collaborative approach of involving people in the work that we do. And then we've included dance in some of our cleanups as well, and as an expression. And then there's ceremonies as well, having some of the Khoisan chiefs come and bless the work that we do. So really trying to get people from all walks of life and drawing on different interests to help us conserve, protect, restore, regenerate our coastal heritage.
How much influence are you getting, for example, with, say, the city of Cape Town, which I think is quite proactive, but the government keeps telling us it can't do things by itself. Do you have a collaborative effort with them? You talk about the cleaning of the tidal pools and that sort of thing, which is the job, I think, of that municipality. How do you collaborate then with officialdom?
Very, very well. Actually, we have a wonderful relationship with Greg Olofse from the city of Cape Town, and they've been instrumental in working with us on changing the cleaning protocols for the tidal pools. A few years ago, Lisa Beasley was part of our team, and she spearheaded the work that was done to try and work with local communities in Cork Bay and St. James, and to convince people that we no longer needed to drain the tidal pools, which was the most harsh impact on the plant and animal life in the pools, and then to use chemicals. So we tested some new ideas with a high pressure hose, and as a result, we've changed the way our tidal pools are cleaned in Cape Town. And we've had communication from people in Australia who were interested in how we did it, and really it's been a fantastic win. And out of that, I mentioned earlier, we worked with Claire to produce some of the art that you find at St. James Tidal Pool. And then through that, the city of Cape Town has been very supportive. And we've also got stenciled graffiti art at Glenken Tidal Pool and at Camps Bay Tidal Pool. And later on in November, on the 14th, I think it is, or 15th of November. We're working with Save Our Seas Foundation and Dalebrook Cafe and The Good Machine. And we'll have a run from the deli in Constantia all the way to Dalebrook Cafe and support of the work that we do at the Beach Cop. So all the proceeds will come to us. And at the same time, Claire will be working on a on an art piece at Dalebrook Tidal Pool. So the slogan for the artwork is Meet the Locals. And really, it's an inclusive, relational way of locals not only being humans, but the more than human as well.
And for a lot of people listening to this, particularly people living inland in Gauteng, listening to you going, okay, that's very nice, but what impact, what difference are you really having? I mean, you know, you're not burning tires in the road. You're not going off to COP17 and telling who's the young woman. Oh, I've forgotten her name. I've just had this like brain freeze. The remarkable Scandinavian woman Greta Thunberg. Thank you. Jeez, how dare I forget Greta's name? You know, she goes and she tells uncomfortable truths, and she goes in hard, and she's non-compromising, and she's confrontational. How do you see your approach complementing that far more public face of agitation against the destruction? And, you know, the planet is being destroyed far more quickly than we're restoring it. And it feels like we're in a bit of a state of climate emergency.
We definitely are. And don't get me wrong, I definitely suffer from eco-anxiety, albeit more recently than, I'm actually surprised that it did catch up with me, because I am an optimist, but the last spill of Nurdles, which we witnessed in August last year.
Nurdles are these microplastic beads that sort of get washed up, and they're tiny, and then the sea life eats these things, swallows them, and that toxicity persists in the environment.
So the spill happened in August off our east coast, and there were containers of them. So they're actually the raw materials from which other plastic products get made. They're also referred to as mermaid's tears. So they aren't tiny bits of microplastics that have broken up from bigger plastic products. They're actually the raw materials to make those plastic products.
Right.
And we had containers fall off a ship, basically, and there's been a huge operation to clean up along our South African coastline by an insurance company called Spiltech, with teams of people in their red overalls cleaning up our coastline. And so that really triggered me quite intensely, and I had to struggle through, and the way I coped with that was by spending time in nature. That is really how I coped. And yes, we do need to be clear that, we're in this dire state, as you say, as you describe. And I think there's definitely a place for the harshness. It's just not the approach that we're taking.
Mm. No, look, I think there are many different ways of approaching it, and you will have resonance with an audience that is put off by loud activism. And so I think it's a smart way of approaching it. Are you making progress? Do you feel like you are making the sort of progress that is having a positive impact?
I feel that we are. You know, I do think that we need to build stronger partnerships, particularly with our corporate partners and the big businesses. And now with the latest legislation out, the extended producer responsibility legislation, which is part of the Waste Management Act, corporates and big businesses that produce plastic or products that have single-use plastic in their product, packaging in particular, they are needing to ensure that they're responsible for how that product ends up where, right? So Absolutely. That they need, yeah, and so this coming into play is really of interest to me and the Beach Corp, because we'd like to use our consumer voice in this process and not, you know, really activating consumers to put pressure on these businesses to ensure that they adhere to the legislation and that they take responsibility for the products that they put on the market, so that we don't continue cleaning up after them. They need to be cleaning up after themselves.
Well, clean up before it becomes a problem. Ania, we must leave it there. And I thank you very much for coming through for us this evening. Ania Umadin, the founder and director at the Beach Co-op. A warning to companies that, of course, produce this sort of stuff that gets chucked away. You do need to approach it differently.